Case number 22-5050 et al. Angela M. Cox, appellant versus Kilolo Kijakazi, Acting Commissioner, Social Security Administration. Ms. Pena for the appellant, Ms. Klein for the appellee.
Good morning, counsel. Ms. Pena, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Tina Pena. I'm here today representing Ms. Angela Cox, who is in the courtroom today. I wanted to make clear a particular point. Listings are special at the Social Security Administration. They are automatic if they are objective, as was listing 1205C for intellectual disability. There's no discretion. The administrative law judge, the other adjudicating officers at the state agency, the doctors, have no discretion. And that matters because under the regulations, 20 CFR 416.501, 416.920 A and T, there is a regulatory guarantee. We will find you disabled if you meet a list. And file an application. And of course, meet the eligibility requirements. The eligibility requirements of income and resources or insurance company. Either way. It's also consistent with the Supreme Court's ruling in Bowen v. Ms. Cox, medalist. She filed an application and she was denied. At the first level of adjudication in front of the doctor, they neglected their duty. They had in front of them the opinion of a consultative examiner that she was disabled, not just that had deficits, she was disabled. They ignored that. They ignored the findings of the IQ test, valid IQ testing, and simply made her wait for years until the agency changed its rule. The agency has no retroactive rulemaking authority. That's quite clear. But nonetheless, it applied. It revised its middle listings, and it applied those to pending cases, court remand cases, and continuing disability review cases. They violated the APA. They did not put any of that out for notice and comment. None of it.
Can I ask you, there's a statutory definition of disability. Which the agency obviously cannot depart.
I'm sorry.
There's a statutory definition of disability that the agency obviously is bound by. The claimant is considered disabled if she is unable to participate in any substantial gainful activity due to a medically determinable physical or mental impairment. And you don't dispute that that's the governing standard of disability.
Yes, Your Honor. The listings are there.
No, I'm just saying, but you accept that that's... You accept that that's the controlling definition of disability that everybody has to meet. And the listings had been a prior way of meeting that.
Yes, that they are an official statement of levels of medical severity, if you will.
But everyone still has to meet the statutory standard that was a means of doing so.
They are a presumption that, and they are a binding presumption that that individual cannot work. I can give you an example.
Well, I'm just trying to understand your legal position. So your legal position is you accept that that is the definition of disability that necessarily bound the agency because it was passed by Congress.
Right.
That's the statute. And you're not claiming that someone who doesn't meet the statutory definition of disability should still get benefits. Are you?
No.
No. So at bottom, everyone has to be found to meet that statutory definition of disability. I'm just trying to understand your position. And your position is that listings are sort of an agency sort of predetermination that if you meet this, one of these criteria, you will necessarily meet the statutory definition.
Exactly so.
But your client still must at bottom, one way or the other, exactly meet so. The statutory
and that's
definition.
That's why the regulation is there that stating that presumption, we will find you disabled.
So as long as she can still show that she meets the statutory definition of disability, she will get
your automatics.
With or without people meet it without. There's other ways there, right? Some people meet it without going through the listings, and they still, as long as they show that they meet the statutory definition of disability, they get the benefits.
The listings are the presumption.
I understand, but some people don't fall within the listings, I assume. And so, but they still can show that they meet the statutory definition of disability by going through the other factors.
If they do not meet a listing, mm-hmm. then yes, mm-hmm. they proceed through the process mm-hmm. and appear before an administrator.
So everybody at the end has to meet the statutory definition.
Does the sequential evaluation process. Mm-hmm. And makes the determination that given the symptoms of the various impairments, this person cannot work. Mm-hmm. In this case, of course, the administrative law judge mischaracterized the evidence. So his final determination was it. But yes, that's it.
No, so your point is, even with or without listings, she meets the definition, and to the extent the ALJ found otherwise here, it was because of error.
If you meet a listing, you are disabled.
No, my question is a little different than that. My question is your argument, as I understand it, is she should be disqualified on two grounds. She met the listing, and even if you put the listings aside, she came in with the evidence that shows she meets the statutory definition of disability.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's just a question of how one goes about proving that you meet the statutory definition of disability, listing or evidence, separate additional evidence or separate evidence. There's two
there
paths.
There are two ways to meet the statutory mm-hmm. definition. Mm-hmm. Listing or an ALJ decision.
Right. And so they left, she still had the opportunity, even under the new regulations, show that she met the statutory definition. That's why you have the arguments about the mistakes that the ALJ made, right?
In theory, yes, ma'am.
In theory, in reality, you have arguments that the ALJ also misweighed evidence and things like
ALJ,
that.
ALJ who did not, and so I'm having some difficulty agreeing mm-hmm. that the opportunity, you have a theoretical opportunity, of course, mm-hmm. hypothetical. But we have an ALJ here who disregarded the listing, disregarded this court's precedents in Butler. So that's my difficulty with agreeing.
No, I'm just asking your position is she would.
Hypothetical.
I'm only asking about your position is that she would meet it either way.
Of course.
Listing or evidence.
Yeah.
Without the listing, with evidence, she would meet it. And so the question is,
right.
The reason they didn't here was just errors by the ALJ.
Yeah. And then talk to me about the notice and comment period. It was 105 days. There were, several comments in that regard. But you're suggesting that there wasn't really notice in such that there couldn't
I'm
be a logical
sorry,
outgrowth.
Having difficulty hearing you.
The notice and comment period was 105 days, several comments that came out, but you're suggesting that there wasn't sufficient notice such that there could be a logical outgrowth of this rule.
I'm still having trouble hearing you, John.
I'm asking you about your position with respect to notice. with respect to this new listing rule. There was a 105-day comment period and several comments made, but you still suggest that this rule would not be a logical outcome.
We do not know who made those comments. They could have come from within the agency. So that's problem number one from our perspective. However, the fact that somebody figured it out, actually they did, somebody made a different suggestion to the agency that the agency had not heretofore proposed. In fact, they proposed the opposite. And I believe the precedents in ALENA make it clear that when an agency specifically proposes, as they did here, to keep a regulation, they cannot simply reverse. Here, they did not put that proposition out for notice of comment. It depended entirely on the possibility that somebody might notice. Somebody did. But that does not allow the agency to escape its notice and opportunity for comment obligations. Secondly, there's no, the final rule contains no explanation, no reason explanation. It does not address how they considered various, or even if they did consider various alternatives. And that's only with respect to listing 1205C. The agency never mentioned that they were taking away the right of this individual to rely on her plausible uncontradicted testimony. Nowhere is that mentioned. They never mentioned taking away the presumption, clinical presumption, that is still used, clinical presumption that IQ levels are stable over a lifetime, barring evidence to the contrary, actual evidence to the contrary.
Make sure there's no additional questions for you at this time. We'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal, and we'll hear from the government. Ms. Klein.
May it please the court, Elisa Klein for the Social Security Administration. I'll be brief, and I want to address the court's questions. Judge Millett, yes, as the Supreme Court in the Yuckert case that we cite emphasized, listings are not comprehensive, and anyone who is not found disabled by virtue of meeting a listing, the inquiry at each stage of the adjudication, whether it's the state level stage or the ALJ stage, then just proceeds to residual functional capacity and the vocational factors, steps 4 and 5. And of course, the agency could not change the statutory standard that determines whether or not benefits will be awarded. This, you know, again, very briefly, as Judge Nichols and Judge Easterbrook explained, the agency's longstanding policy is to instruct its adjudicators at every level to use the most up-to-date listings. You know, these are the most up-to-date medical standards when they're adjudicating an application for benefits. And that's a permissible policy under the broad discretion that Congress gave to the administration to basically oversee this gigantic apparatus of processing applications for benefits. And it is not retroactive in the Landgraf sense for the reasons that were set out by Judge Nichols and in our brief.
You don't dispute that. Or do you dispute that had the listings been applied, that she would have been entitled to benefits?
We do dispute that. We've assumed, we're not asking this court to decide that, but there's a chart in our district court brief on page 7 mm-hmm. that sets out side by side the central requirements under the prior listing 1205 and under the 2017 version. And as we explained in our brief, it was always a requirement to show deficits in adaptive functioning. That requirement—
Even as part of the listings?
Yes, yes, as part of listing 1205. So same, the name was different. Intellectual disorder at the time was called mental retardation and the name got changed, but the substantive showing of deficits in adaptive functioning was present under the—
So even if she met the sort of IQ range—
Yes.
That would not automatically get her benefits.
Exactly. And I'm not suggesting there was no change. There's more specificity in the 2017 version of that listing, 12.05, that talks about the severity and has some more detail. But our point, and again, we're not asking this court to decide it. We're just making the point that the administrative law judge went through and found, like, addressed each of the areas of deficits in adaptive functioning and made findings with respect to those. So while we are assuming for purposes of the retroactivity analysis that this change made a difference, we're not conceding. And, but again—
So if we assume that, though, at least in National Mining Congress, we had language that said where a rule changes the law in a way that adversely affects the party's prospects for success, success on the merits of the claim, it may operate retroactively. So if you're assuming for purposes of this case that it definitely changed her success on the merits, not just her prospects, but actual success on the merits, how is that standard not met?
Because that language from National Mining, which is what the district court relied on in this case, has to be understood in the context of the statute, the particular program that was at issue there. This court did not and could not change this court's prior decisions in Chadmore and the line that we cite in our brief that said an applicant for government benefits has no vested right while the application is pending. And that's just a general principle also referenced by Judge Easterbrook in the McCabe case. National Mining was different, potentially unique, because the benefits were being paid by the employer. So the whole issue in the case was, could the Department of Labor apply, I'm using retroactive in a colloquial sense, retroactively apply new rules in a way that increased the liability of the employers, the coal mine operators and their insurance companies. So if you look back at the briefing, the whole fighting, there was no dispute that that would have implicated Landgraf, and the fighting was over whether there were or were not material changes to the regulations, but you can't take that language and pull it out of the unusual context in which the benefits at issue were payable by the private employer.
That's a question about the treating physician part of the challenge. So under the regulations, they presuppose that the treating physician's opinion can have greater weight than somebody else. And I just didn't see anything in the ALJ's treatment of the treating physician that A, acknowledged that it was a treating physician, and then B, wrestled with whether, because it's the treating physician, I guess it was Hawthorne, whether Dr. Hawthorne was the treating physician, notwithstanding the fact of treating physician status, there still was going to be a discount of those views for the reasons that were set out.
All right. So I took it as implicit that the ALJ understood that Colleen Hawthorne was the treating physician, because the ALJ then did go through and explain why she was being given partial weight rather than, you know, greater weight as would be expected of a treating physician. And the ALJ—
But wasn't there similar language about other opinions too? The partial weight went to other physicians too. It just didn't seem like there was a distinction based on treating physician status.
Since I don't believe this was the focus of the appeal, I don't recall the specifics, but as we understood it, yes, of course, the ALJ knew this was a treating physician, but said that this was, you know, with respect to Hawthorne herself,
There
were contradictions in her own, I don't remember if it was testimony in medical records, in addition to contradictions with other physicians, you know, and other evidence. But again, we would not be here if the only issue were the treating physician. So I want to make sure the court is satisfied as to retroactivity, which is why we appealed. And I also just want to make sure I address, Judge Childs, your question about logical outgrowth. And to just go back to this chart, the changes to this listing, they're certainly important. It is important to align the listings with the up-to-date, you know, categories that are used by the American Psychological Association, you know, the outside experts. And those experts, their own treatment that informs what the clinical records look like. So this is important, but the changes were still comparatively modest. And what happened was, after the agency made various reorganization to this particular listing, 12.05, comments came in and said, paragraph C is now unnecessary and you should streamline this listing, you know, to avoid complicating the process for the adjudicator. And that's why, I mean, it's certainly a logical outgrowth if the agency takes into account the fact that commentators who are being asked, you know, to comment on what do you think of this proposal, say, do this thing to simplify the work of the adjudicators, that it's reasonable.
Well, it's not a logical outgrowth of the notice that says we will not change 1205C except for minor editorial adjustments. That's language to that effect is what was used. We will not be changing it. And you are assuming for purposes of this argument, so I assume you're assuming it for purposes of the whole argument, that she would have won under this provision that's now been eliminated. That doesn't seem at all like a logical outgrowth of a we're not changing it. And it seems like a profoundly substantive change from the perspective of the claimants.
The premise is very wrong. Obviously, mm-hmm. there was no statement, we will not change paragraph C, but also, again,
only minor editorial?
No, but this is going back to the other point. I think that the plaintiff is missing that all along there was a requirement to show deficits in adaptive functioning. Things got moved around and there was, you know, more specificity as to that showing, but that was always going to be a required showing, you know, even if you applied the old version of the listing.
But it wouldn't be enough under the new. If you have that, you may need deficits in adaptive functioning, but that wouldn't get you all the way home under the listings, well, right? Because you still have to show more.
As now. Before, you had to show, you know, the IQ testing. That's not a change.
No, but I'm taking that as a given too. So the IQ range plus deficits of adaptive functioning under the new provision, there's still, you have to show extreme limitation of one or marked limitation of two of the following areas of mental functioning, and then the list A, B, C, or D.
Yeah, to be clear, those are the deficits in adaptive functioning. The terminology has changed, and it is more specific. It's, you know, to describe the level of severity, it had to be extreme in one or moderate in two. But this is all just deficits in adaptive functioning. I just want to make sure that the court understands, because I know it's complicated, that yes. This was, in many ways, a reorganization that made C unnecessary.
But I thought we're taking as a given that the change... I know there was some reorganization and some encapsulation, but I thought we're taking as a given that there's a delta between what existed pre 20, whatever year it is, the 2017 listings, and now. And there were things that would have automatically qualified you as disabled under the listings previously that wouldn't necessarily get you all the way home now.
Yes, with the pause on automatically, there had to be a showing of deficits in adaptive functioning. And that's why, in response to her argument that there should be a remand for an award of benefits, we've said no. The ALJ addressed deficits in adaptive functioning and said...
Right. I mean, we may not remand to get to automatically give benefits, but just in terms of whether somebody's worse off. I thought we're taking it as a given that somebody could be worse off under the new listings than the old ones. They might still be able to satisfy steps four and five, even if they don't automatically get in under the listings. I get that. But in terms of automatically getting in under the listings, somebody could be worse off under the new approach than the previous one.
Yes, we're taking that as a given. It is, of course, also true that in general, there's nothing systematic about updating the medical listings that disadvantages claimants as a class. And so there may well be many claimants who say, wait, you added a listing. You should be adjudicating my application with the benefit. And then just finally, the broad point.
So just to be clear, someone prior to 2017, if they showed that they met the, for one of the listings, sort of the IQ range plus deficits in adaptive functioning, they showed both of those, you know, go directly to benefits, right? They automatically would get benefits.
There was another category. It's in the chart. It's an additional impairment that affects the ability to work.
Right, and they also have to show it was before 20 or 22 or whatever that was. But so they do that. And then now someone can make that exact same showing. They wouldn't get benefits automatically. They still have to go through steps 4 and 5, or at least step 5.
We're assuming that the additional specificity for the deficits in adaptive functioning category may actually make a difference for someone. Yep.
They still have to go through steps 4 and 5.
Yes, we're assuming.
Particularly that. The vocational step 5.
And then you go through steps 4 and 5 and can show that I nonetheless meet the statutory.
Right, but there's a group of people, in theory, at least a group of people who would have qualified before.
Right. Like the other courts, we are assuming, you know, for purposes of this appeal, yes, that could happen. But we're also making the more general point that there's nothing about updating medical listings that systematically disadvantages claimants. And the final point, if I may, is that as the Supreme Court, you know, repeatedly admonished, this is a gigantic and very complicated adjudicatory system. And so efficiency, maybe in some context, doesn't matter very much. But for the Social Security Administration, keeping things simple and fast for the adjudicators is very important because of how long people wait to get a decision, even at the first level, on their applications for benefits. So the recent statistics were 5.5 months at that first level, where a very large percentage are granted. So this is part of the reason the Supreme Court has consistently emphasized that the Social Security Administration, by statute, has really broad discretion to figure out the mechanisms, the procedures by which its adjudicators determine whether someone meets the statutory requirements.
But you don't argue that any different retroactivity analysis applies in this context, do you? Because it's actually hard, really hard to figure out how to do it for exactly the reason you said. Changes, the same change can help someone and hurt someone else. And so how do we decide, sort of under a Landgraf type analysis, whether?
So the Landgraf analysis here should be straightforward for the reasons Judge Nichols set out. We're not increasing liability for anyone. We're not attaching new adverse consequences to primary conduct that happened in the past. And so the only issue is the one Judge Nichols walked through about vested rights. And under this court's decision in Chadmore and the case it cites, there is no vested right when you just have an application for government benefits.
Well, could the consequences of having performed some work before change?
No, so I'm glad the court asked this question, because this is where the distinction between Social Security disability insurance and SSI is potentially relevant, but I want to explain why it shouldn't be. So this case is Social Security, SSI. This is, you know, sort of the pure welfare program that was added in the 70s. The Supreme Court, though, cautioned in Fleming versus Nestor, and in a way in Matthews versus Eldridge, that even when you're talking about the category of workers who paid into the system and for that reason became entitled to either retirement benefits was Fleming versus Nestor, or disability insurance benefits was Matthews versus Eldridge, the court still cautioned about not importing, at least at a constitutional level, these accrued property rights notions. That's when the Supreme Court said this would freeze up a system that depends upon flexibility in a way that was not intended. So the issue is not before the court here, but I just want to caution that the court should not accidentally suggest that there's nothing the Social Security Administration could do to streamline what are called its continuing disability reviews that it's required to do by statute, which is once someone is a recipient, you know, it's been found entitled, there's nonetheless a periodic, you know, could be 5-year, 7-year, shorter inquiry into whether that person should still be getting benefits. And I'm just—
Is there anything the Social Security Administration could do with respect to changing the listings that would be retroactive?
The Social Security Administration's policy is that at that continuing disability stage review, changes in the listings are not considered. So there's nothing, you know, barring a hypothetical change to that policy that could be done to the listings that would be retroactive.
So no matter how much the listings change.
Correct, because the listings
couldn't be retroactive.
And to put it the way the Supreme Court put it is, this is for, you know, initial applicants, it's a way of streamlining the adjudicators.
Right, so to cut to the chase, there's nothing you could do, no matter how much more restrictive the listings got in terms of automatically qualifying as disabled without having to go through steps 4 and 5, it definitionally can't be retroactive.
Correct.
And just to understand, I want to follow up on Judge Millett's question. So as I understand the assumptions on which we're resolving this case, it has nothing to do with steps 4 and 5, because under step three, the assumption on which we're considering the case is that pre-2017, someone might have qualified as disabled. Post-2017, that same person won't automatically qualify as disabled for step three. They might still qualify as disabled under step 4 and 5, but they're worse off in a way that could be outcome determinative, because if they don't qualify under 4 and 5, they would have qualified pre-17 under step three. Post-2017, they don't qualify.
Yeah, those are the assumptions.
Those are the assumptions,
to Judge Nichols' decision.
Yeah. And your argument is
that's not retroactive.
It can't be retroactive because it's just the automatic qualification under the listings, and definitionally that can never be retroactive.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And I will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Streamlining has absolutely nothing to do with depriving my client of her right to make her prima facie case on her uncontradicted plausible testimony. That is guaranteed by Goldberg v. Kelly. She had a right the minute she filed that application, and her IQ scores were confirmed. She had a right to her finding of disability. They made her wait. People wait, but they don't wait because they don't get decisions they were supposed to get a lot of the time. This regulations guarantee if your impairment meets the listing, you are disabled, and we will make that finding, and they did not. The notice and comment, there are no reason for explanations. There's no reason for taking away her right to plausible uncontradicted testimony. There's no reason for taking away the presumption of IQ. None of that was ever discussed by the agency. This was not anything, had nothing to do with streamlining. This had to do with cutting the budget. That's what it is. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.